I'm Laura Vinroot Poole of Capital, and this is What We Wore. Stephanie Dannon is a film producer turned fashion designer. With a little bit of money and no experience, she designed her collection Co, that was quickly embraced by her clients and the fashion industry. A lot of these podcasts start this way where I say, I think I met you through Irene, which I think I did, right?
So funny. Of course you did. Of course you did. She's the ultimate connector of this planet.
And I can remember, I think that first collection was shown in the Mercer Hotel.
Yes.
And I think that was it. Maybe Irene was staying there and you said, I want you to come see my friend who has this amazing collection.
That's exactly how it happened. I can't believe what a great memory you have. Her and I would have kale salad in the lobby. And she was showing there too, right?
She would always stay there and show.
Exactly.
There,
yeah. That was a long time ago. What are we talking about here? 2015?
Yeah. Wow. You're not from Los Angeles. Where did you grow up?
No, I am originally from Morocco. Both my parents are Moroccan.
From what part?
My father from Fez and my mother from Marrakesh. And in the 70s, they moved to Montreal, Canada, where I grew up until I went to college in Boston, where I went to film school. And between then and moving to LA, I lived in New York, I lived in Paris, and I moved to Los Angeles in 1999.
Other than Montreal being the place where the most beautiful people in the world live. And one of the most beautiful cities, I think.
Isn't it crazy how great Montreal is? I have not been in a while, but it's true that it was a very fashionable city.
Very.
Very cutting edge and very hip and a lot of beautiful people and great restaurants. I know, it's a very cosmopolitan city.
And the most incredible food.
Yes.
The bagels are amazing.
Best bagels ever.
But tell me about growing up in Montreal and also about Morocco. Did y'all go in the summers to Morocco?
Yes. Every summer in April, we would go for a couple of weeks. We would go for Christmas. We would go in the summers. So most of my vacations were spent in Casablanca, actually. Growing up in Montreal was really interesting because you had that sort of Francophone, Anglophone kind of mix.
Yeah.
You know, and my parents were in fashion.
In what part, Stephanie?
My father had a showroom and he distributed brands like Fiorucci, Chevignon,
oh, wow.
Marie-Thérèse-François Girbeau, Jean-Paul Gaultier.
Wow.
So he had an incredible showroom. And my mother had her own line, which was distributed all over Canada. And, you know, we were part of this sort of small Jewish Moroccan community. Yeah. And we traveled to Morocco every summer, where I have some of my best memories. And then later in life, my father returned to Morocco. He missed it so much. I think the Canada winters were a shock to the system.
What did you love about being with your family in Morocco? Was it very different than your life in Montreal?
Oh, so different. So different.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Moroccans are very funny. They have zero boundaries. It's, you know, a free for all of food. It's so funny because whenever I've dated American men, they were like, when you're with your family, all you guys do is scream and yell at each other. And I was like, no, it's how we communicate. And for an American, that was always like, whoa, this is nuts. You know, it's a little bit like Italians, you know what I mean? It's very animated. And, you know, our summers in Morocco were just, you know, it was the beach, it was the souk, it was food, it was family, incredible weather, traveling to Marrakesh on the weekends. It was full of life, to be honest with you. And I love to go back there and I hope to have a house there one day. That's kind of my dream.
What did you interpret about the fashion industry through your mom and dad in Morocco and also in Montreal?
You know, the thing is, in Morocco, even like, you know, the street urchins have great taste.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the nature and the color of the earth and the desert mixing with the mountains and the snow and the landscape and the light. But I think we grew up with a real sense of refinement. the color palettes. I mean, we grew up with a lot of value in what we wore and the textures and the fabrics. And so it comes kind of in our DNA, I would say. And so my parents, when they arrived in Montreal, they were very glamorous comparatively, and there was no fashion in the 70s there at all. And so they were very much part of a community of people who really brought a taste level that hadn't been part of the community, you know? And I think that comes from Morocco, to be honest with you. And, you know, when you see, you know, why Yves Saint Laurent had a house there, and why so many designers have Riyadhs, and why, you know, they all go there for inspiration. It's because when you're in that, you know, level of visceral life, you know, it feels so visceral. And it's, you know, when you're in the souk and you see all the fabrics and the pottery and all of these artisans, it's just, I don't know, it's so inspiring, you know? And so I think I grew up around that. My aunts, my uncles, my cousins, you know, getting well-dressed was very important. You know what I mean? You didn't go and sit at the table unless you were dressed. You didn't, you know what I mean? You had to pay attention to your clothes. You know, you had to pay attention to the elegance and how you presented yourself. It was definitely part of my upbringing. So I would say that it just seeped inside of me very early on.
Were there other women outside of your mother that you admired their style?
I have an aunt who lives in Paris, who is my father's sister, who only wears white. She's only worn white for 50 years. And she has sort of, you know, she's in her 80s now, and she has this long braid, and she has, the elegance is off the charts. And I would say that I had incredible admiration for her. The way she cooks, the way her house is put together, the way she handles herself, everything is just impeccable. So I would say that my aunt Paralyzed, definitely one of them. My mother was a great and is a great beauty and always put together. I mean, I feel like some of my aunts, literally, we buried them in Chanel suits. You know what I mean? Like it was like being coquette part of my upbringing, yeah. For sure. I've been really lucky to be surrounded with women who had a great sense of style and who were, you know, always elegant and always walked in the room and made an impression.
And always confident, sounds like.
Very.
With all of this fashion and beauty around you, you went into film instead of fashion.
Yes. So I sort of rejected the fashion industry later in my adolescence and later in life because, you know, while I admired these, you know, learned to admire all of my aunts and mom and, you know, all these women who were so elegant, you know, there's a lot of pressure in always being put together. You know what I mean? And I wanted to rebel a little bit against that. So I said, I'm not interested in this. You know, I want to go and actually tell stories about real characters and real people. I don't care about the outside. I want to go and dig deep inside people's characters and their human nature. You know what I mean? And so I decided to go to film school and spent, you know, 4 years in Boston, you know, sort of making student films. And then I met a filmmaker and we made a movie, and I was 21, and Miramax saw the film and they bought the film, which was kind of a huge deal for a 21-year-old. So that was kind of the beginning of my film career. And I then moved to New York and got mentored by John Sayles and Maggie Renzi, who were great filmmakers, because I had bought the rights to a novel very, very young and decided to adapt it and wanted to direct it. So that was kind of where I was at in my super, super early 20s. And then I moved to Paris to make the film. The film never got made, but it was a time in my life where I met a lot of filmmakers and actors and artists in Paris. And it was, you know, I went to Cannes, and it was an incredibly rich time for me. And I really spent a lot of time writing and getting deeper. You know what I mean? Like not looking at sort of the surface of what you look like and what your clothes look like, but getting really deep. And what's interesting is that later it all comes together, right? Full circle.
The film industry seems exciting, but also frustrating because it sounds like a really long process. And oftentimes things just in the end don't get made.
Exactly. So I experienced that a little bit at the beginning of my career and then moved to Los Angeles to start a company with a French filmmaker who I'd met in Paris. The company was, you know, very well known for, you know, I bought the rights to plays and books, and I worked with incredible filmmakers from Gore Verbinski to Nicole Holofcener to the Duplass brothers to, you know, writers like Alan Loeb and Steve Conrad. It was such an incredible time for me, but I was extremely frustrated by the process and how long it took, even though, you know, I had 20 films at all the studios, all in development. You know, there was a certain amount of frustration, and I'm a very impatient person. So, you know, the patience of development did not suit my personality at all. And so, you know, around 2010, when I think there was a huge transition in the industry and when television started to really, like, you know, it was The Sopranos and Sex and the City, all of these shows had really had an impact on how we, you know, we made content. And so there was a transition from film to television that was pretty radical at that time. And it was at the same time that I met my ex-partner and that we decided to create Co.
Were you increasingly frustrated with not being able to find clothes that, you know, made you feel like you were taken seriously, or there had to have been some things in between that?
So it's a lot of different things, right? So it's very interesting that you bring them up, because I would say that as a, you know, I was this young producer in Hollywood. I was coquette coming from, you know, sort of this world that I had come up from. And fashion was always still part of what I love. I love to get dressed. I love to go to Barney's and buy a beautiful dress. I mean, it was, you know, it was still there. You know what I mean? I wasn't like, I rejected it in terms of my career, but I was still, you know, I loved beautiful clothes and getting dressed. But I did notice, speaking of what you just brought up, I did notice that it was hard to be taken seriously as a young woman who was chic and coquette in Hollywood at the time.
Yeah.
It was like, it was a combination of that. And I do think that it did impact getting the films that I had in development made, because I think that I would walk into meetings, you know, sort of looking outside, I looked like I was different, you know what I mean? Than sort of, you know, all of the other, you know, producers or agents or, you know, and I think it did have an impact on whether or not the films got made. And I think I did get a little bit judged for that, you know, and I think I didn't get to be taken too seriously. So it was almost that, colliding with the business changing so much, colliding with, you know, meeting my ex-partner, who was coming more from a, you know, he was more in the fashion industry at the time and the art world, which at the time Hollywood was super insular.
Yeah.
It did not have, you know, agents running around to art galleries. It did not have, you know, I mean, it was literally like all we talked about was film.
Yeah.
It was so boring. People did not have a view on the outside world, which is something fashion always had.
Yeah.
People who are in fashion and who are curious and intelligent and worldly are interested in all kinds of things. Art, film, you know what I mean? Travel. And Hollywood at the time was not like that.
Interesting.
So when I met my ex-partner, I was sort of like, wow, there is something more than Hollywood. You know what I mean? And so it was all of these different things colliding that led to starting Co, along with the fact that I did feel like when I went to Barney's as a young producer who did not want to shop on the contemporary floor where it's a billion pairs of jeans and a trillion t-shirts and like just a mass amount of product, who wanted to sort of shop the second floor in the Beverly Hills store that felt more curated, that there was not a luxury brand that spoke to me in terms of, you know, versatility, price point, you know, that spoke to me in terms of like what my life looked like and what I could and could not afford and where my interests were. You know, everything was sort of overpriced. At the time, you couldn't speak about pricing. You know, the word luxury was like, now it's overused, but at the time word luxury was like this new thing where everybody sort of adopted that word, you know? And I was like, okay, so what is a woman like me who makes a pretty good living, right? But who has a lot of other interests besides fashion, right? And who doesn't want to put all her money in a handbag. Where does this girl shop?
How challenging was that for your identity to go from being this person that was known for being intelligent and creative and producing films to being a designer? Did your friends and your colleagues all love the way you dressed? I mean, you were sort of your client, right?
I was my client. It was funny. In Hollywood, people, you know, people would call me and be like, I'm getting engaged. Where do I get the ring? Where do I get the wedding dress? I'm going to this part, this premiere. What should I wear? You know? And I was like, well, I'm a film producer. I can help you and I have advice for you, but I'm not, you know, the transition was at first people were like, you're crazy. And, you know, and then we got really lucky, you know, sort of at the right time at the right place. I knew how to tell a story because it was what I had done for the last 20 years. And the story was the story of who I really am. And that I think that I was and still am the reflection of my customer. And, you know, which is, again, a woman who just wants a beautiful wardrobe, but who is not fashion obsessed and who has other interests.
Did you talk through it with your parents? Did they have advice when you said you wanted to do it? And did you understand sort of what you would need for a first collection, that it needed to be 30 pieces, say, or all the components? I don't even know what the components are, but you probably do.
I didn't get any advice as far as the components. I definitely went on my instinct with that. But the advice that my mother did give me was, and this is, I think, really good advice for anyone who starts a brand. Your factories and your production are the most important. Like, you really can't, and people tend to ignore that, right? Because they're all in their design headspace and delivering the collections on time. Mm. So important. So,
well, especially if you're dealing with department stores.
Exactly. And because I was a movie producer, I knew how to put a schedule together and I knew how to, you know what I mean? I knew how to produce it. I knew to make sure that we got from point A of an idea, executing the idea, delivering the idea, marketing the idea. So I kind of used my film production experience and I said, well, I'm just going to use this experience and just pour it into making clothes. And it worked. Because at the end of the day, it's kind of the same thing, right?
I think, Stephanie, that's the thing that's so interesting is I've never seen in almost 30 years a collection that has been responded to that quickly and that vigorously. And I think it's so funny. Every single time I walk into my appointment with you, and this is kind of industry speak, but when I talk to Amanda, or, you know, about the sell-through, my sell-through is, I'm always like, sell-through was, you know, it's like 99.9% or something like that. You know, something that's really you shouldn't have because it means you're not buying enough.
Right. I love that. Are you kidding?
No, I've never had a collection like that in the history of my business. I've never. But I mean, did you know that from the beginning? Like, how did it, it was crazy how it took off.
You know, our first appointment was Barney's. I used a lot the price point in it as in terms of entry. Obviously, like there was the clothes and how I wanted these clothes to just feel like so easy to wear, so easy to put together. I wanted ease. I wanted to always service a woman in terms of like, I don't want you to have to think about it in the morning. We don't want to have to think about it, right? Because it's too much, you know, where we don't have those kinds of lives. So that was obviously the first thing. But the second thing was also, I want a woman to feel like she's buying something with value. These days, it's like, it's so hard. You go to a restaurant, it's overpriced. You go to buy a bag, it's over. Everything feels like you're like
babysitters.
Babysitters, exactly. everything. It's like I'm like moving right now and I'm just like, I can't find a move that makes sense in terms of how much everything is so expensive. And I wanted a woman to feel like, wow, this is worth what I'm buying. This is something I'm going to wear all the time. The price is not outrageous. The quality is still good. So they're not giving up on quality, and that the overall picture. And you know, the greatest thing that somebody told me one day was I walked into Neiman Marcus and I met the teams. And I think we were having a clinic or something. And they said, the thing about your clothes is that the women turn the price tag twice because they can't believe it. You know what I mean?
It's a mistake.
That was the goal. That was the goal. That was the goal. Even though everyone was like, don't talk price point. No one cares. And I was like, I don't know. I care.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of finances, I think people seem to misperceive that you were given the financial backing to start the company or you had a leg up somehow. How did you initially fund the company?
I had $30,000 in my bank account and I used it. Every bit of it. There was no money. There's no family funding. There's no nothing. I used that $30,000, which I had probably gotten from an option of a book. I had optioned to Universal or something, a script or something like that. I remember it was probably some money that I had put aside from a film. You know, my partner and I, the deal was that we would each put in $30,000, which we did. And we started it with $60,000, no marketing, no nothing. It was really just, you know, we lived very humbly the first 2 years. We had our racks in our kitchen. We had interns coming in and out of our living room. We, you know, it was really like, you know, it's interesting. And I think that because the imagery was very clean and very well made. And I think it came also from the fact that I had a film background and I was able to, you know, really bring on a lot of friends who helped us to make our short films at the beginning. And because we made all these movies around the collections and, you know, great photographers who came and helped us. It looked like we had a lot of money, but we really didn't.
Was there a moment when you felt like the company had a real future?
Yes. In 2015, Andrew Rosen came to our office downtown. Andrew Rosen is, you know, he's sort of, I mean, what would be a good comparison? I guess he's the American LVMH. I mean, he's, you know, he has a portfolio of incredible brands. He started Theory. He has both invested and mentored hundreds of designers. He has an incredible portfolio. And he happened to come to our office. You know, he had heard about us. And we sat down with him. And within half an hour, he said, I'm in.
Wow.
Okay, now we're, you know, now it's serious. Because before then, yeah, sure, we sold to Barney's and a few incredible multi-brand stores. But, you know, we used a bank in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which my partner had worked at when he was in high school. And, you know, we were just like packing and shipping out of the living room. And so when Andrew came in, we were like, okay, we need to step this up and make this a serious business. So I think that was the turning point for us. And in Andrew, we found not only somebody who helped us financially, he also had great relationships with department stores, and he was a great mentor, I would say. You know, his value is like threefold, really.
Was becoming an entrepreneur natural for you?
I think so. I think it's the Moroccan gene too. You know, I think that we all like, you know, I was probably in a past life in the souk selling carpets, you know?
What's the most challenging thing about it?
It's hard to go through the ups and downs. You know what I mean? I would say that you just don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. There's very little security. Fashion is very fickle. You have to be very careful and always, you know, as my mother says, stack some cash under the mattress. Because you just don't know what, you know, and I feel like, you know this, it's like, during market, you know, buyers come in and one season it's the economy is not doing great. One season it's there's an election year. One season it's, you know, fashion is trending towards, you know, if your aesthetic is different from that trend, you have to navigate that. It's the department stores are not doing well. There's always something, yeah. I feel, you know. And it doesn't matter how great the collections are or how hard you've worked on the price point or how early you deliver, there's always some challenge to navigate. And so you have to have really thick skin in this business. And it's
Yeah.
You know, it moves really fast. So here you are, you know, delivering four collections and you still feel like you hear, well, we need some newness. And you're like, how much newness can you bring? You know what I mean?
I've done it four times. Yeah.
So, you know, and it's like quiet luxury and you have color, you're doomed. And if it's not quiet luxury and you don't have color, you're doomed. So you're just kind of, you have to navigate a lot. And so it's a lot of balls in the air. And I think that, you know, being an entrepreneur is not easy. You have your freedom, which is fantastic. And you get to, you know, control your destiny to a certain extent, but it's not an easy life, the life of an entrepreneur, you know?
Yeah, I do know. Talk to me a little bit about moving to Paris and what you expect, what you hope to find there.
So basically we had a designer at the company for a really long time who started as our intern and who ended up being our head designer for about 10 years. And it was this incredible relationship that I really cherish. Just one of the things about having your own business is you really create a family,
yeah,
right? And it's one of the most satisfying parts, I think, about being an entrepreneur is to lead a family and love a family and take care of a family, you know, with all its ups and downs, obviously. Our designer was starting a family, and it was sort of, you know, we've been together for 10 years, and, you know, Los Angeles is not the hub of fashion in any way, shape, or form. Certainly not, you know, it's denim and t-shirts and sweatshirts. It's great for us. So finding a design team here is challenging. And I thought, maybe this is the time where I should go and find someone in Europe. And we did. And this little team started to grow and grow, especially as I, you know, reached out to someone I was a huge fan of even before I started Co, which is Samuel Dreira, who has a magazine called Incense, which to me is, you know, one of the most beautiful fashion magazines and has been a, you know, sort of just an inspiration in terms of styling and silhouettes and volume. And just, I would definitely say that this is a magazine that a lot of designers look at, and it's very small, but anyone in fashion should absolutely pick up this magazine. So I'd been a fan for a really long time, and I reached out to him and I said, I really want to work with you. And coincidentally, his partner at his office had said, have you seen this brand? Like maybe 2 or 3 days before I reached out. And we developed a friendship for a few years before we started working together, because I had not yet created my team in Paris. And when I did create my team in Paris, I was like, Samuel, it's time. And so all of a sudden I had Samuel and Jessica and Paola and this incredible team who both live in Milan and Paris. And I started to work with them, and the collection started to feel like they were really evolving,
yeah,
in like, you know, and as I was evolving, because a lot of change was happening in my own life. And so as this change was happening, both in the collection, in my own personal life, my son was, you know, growing up, I started to feel like I'd spent 25 years in LA and it was time for me to go to France. And I got an apartment there and I started to go back and forth and back and forth because I was waiting for my son to graduate from grade 5 into grade 6. Yeah. And I got really inspired. It was a time for me as I was going back and forth. My weeks in Paris were weeks of creativity, healing. They were times for me to find my, you know, find myself again, reinvent myself as I was turning 50. It's a lot of change.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I love those times in your lives. You know what I mean? Like when you're in transition, I feel like they feel like the hardest times. But when you look back, they are the best of times.
You've actually written about this. You've written essays on the site. And what's that been,
yes,
like? It's so extraordinary to see that and to read that, because people in fashion, everybody acts like everything's fine all the time and, yes, everything's perfect. It's so touching to be able to read something real.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, I've always loved writing, and I wanted to write and speak to women like me who go through similar things, right?
And women that wear your clothes. I mean, I think.
And women that wear my clothes, is exactly. That woman who wears my clothes, she's working. She has a family. She has to, you know, she has to put a home together. She has to struggle with getting older. She has to struggle with difficult relationships. She has to struggle with divorce. She has to struggle with raising children. She has to struggle with her identity. She has to struggle with a world changing and being relevant. She has to struggle with so many of the same things that I have had to struggle with in the last few years. And I wanted to speak to her as a real woman, not just as a designer, but like as a woman who was going through a lot of very difficult things. And so speaking to her, and it was kind of my way to dialogue with her. And I was really lucky. I have a friend, Amanda Fortini, who's a fantastic writer and editor, who really wanted to support me through this process. And working with her was the healing of the last 2 years for me. I would say that being in that Paris apartment, working with an incredible editor who lives in Montana and who, you know, writes for the New York Times and New Yorker and is just unbelievable. Our phone conversations would last 2 and 3 hours, and we would just dig deep into what it means to be a woman today and how it even translates into our clothes and, you know, how I was evolving as a woman and how my taste was changing and evolving also, and how transformation is so hard and incredible, and how I was in this little cocoon as this, you know, butterfly trying to break through the cocoon with her as I was writing, and wanted to share that with, you know, the small community of people who buy our clothes and who, you know, I got a lot of messages who were basically like, me too.
Yeah.
You know how you feel. And that's the best message you can get.
You, more than maybe any other designer that I know of, you really make your clients feel like everything's okay. You don't wear these clothes and feel like, well, I got to go lose 100 pounds if I want to wear this, you know, or, right. You know, it's just, they're so comforting and respectful almost. I don't know that you know the market as well as maybe I do, just seeing all the collections, right. But I think your collection, more than any other I can think of, does that, just is respectful to women and comforting.
Oh, that's so incredible to hear, to be honest with you, because that's what I try to do, is to bring humanity in what I do. You know, and it doesn't matter that it's clothes or film or decor, whatever, you have to bring humanity. And I feel like being vulnerable has been an incredible experience for me. I believe in it, and I believe in being real with people. It doesn't matter if they're in fashion, and if they don't like it and they can't respect it or they are afraid of it, then that's not our people, right?
But don't you think that's new for you, Stephanie? I mean, that was this process, wasn't it? Because I think early on, because nobody in fashion does that, shares how they really feel.
You know, it's always been my nature to be myself, but I think that this last 2 to 3 years, it really came out.
Yeah.
I started to feel like, well, if I'm going to be in pain, I don't want to be in pain and pretend I'm not in pain, because that's even more painful, right? So I'm going to be in pain and I'm going to be in pain. And you know what? That's going to liberate me.
One of the best pieces of advice that you've received, you said, is don't wait until the idea is fully fleshed out before you start executing. Otherwise, you may never do it. Why is this so important for an entrepreneur?
I think that we can get caught up in trying to deliver perfection, and in that we miss the window of execution. So we have to be both very connected to the artistry, but we have to also equally, I would say, be connected to the importance of executing in the right time. Sometimes you don't need perfection in your vision. You need to just start going. It'll come together.
I haven't had that many Canadian designers on the podcast. Do you have proms in Canada?
What do you mean by proms?
The question we always ask our guests is, what did you wear to prom?
Oh, a prom. Oh, yes. It's a prom. Oh, my God. Well,
do they have proms in Canada?
They do have proms. They do. And I remember mine very clearly. And my mother made my dress.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
And tell me about it.
Well, I remember it was, listen, it was the 80s. So let's
me too.
So I had the hairspray, the whole thing. You know what I mean? I was born in 73. So by the time there was a prom, it was full on the 80s. I had a, it was a sort of both, it was a mix of velvet and taffeta. It had a sort of a pencil skirt with a bustier top.
What color?
It was black and burgundy.
Ooh.
I know.
The skirt was burgundy and the velvet was black?
Mixed, because
this
had sort of a drape in the front that was taffeta over a pencil skirt that was velvet. I mean, this is crazy.
Amazing.
And then I had, it was the bustier, you know what I mean? Bustiers were so 80s. And it had the bustier, which had sort of, it was a velvet bustier with sort of a taffeta flap over it, and then it had a corset in the back, you know, that you pulled, which was so 80s.
Yes. And shoes and accessories?
And shoes and accessories. Oh, I do not remember the heels.
We remember the hair.
The hair had a ton of hairspray, I have to say. A ton. And some teasing too. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I love it. Well, Stephanie, what a treat. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much. I love talking to you, and I'm so honored that you asked me, really.
Likewise. No, it was a treat. Thank you, and I'll see you in Paris soon. What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. Please follow us on Instagram at What We Wore Podcast for additional content and show updates. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.